the Force is,
the Force is a coincidence is what the Force is. That's when and how the dam bursts. That itch, the tickle in my brain, floods my skull and crashes into my memory. Our mission on Tatooine was to locate and detain a pair of droids. And I saw those droids. An old man fanned his fingers at me and I can't believe this. I let them pass. I didn't even check his papers. I just sent them through. I have never disobeyed a single order, and now I... Ow! I crack my head on the threshold on my way into the control room. It snaps me back into the moment. There are dead men all over the place. TK-421 is dead. I didn't know TK-421 well, but he was strong. He didn't deserve this. None of them did. Our soldiers are dead, but there is no sign of anyone to punish for it. Punishment. I will be punished for what I did on Tatooine. I deserve to be. Why would I let them through? Why wouldn't I check their identification? My own voice echoes in my ears. Move along. I must have a parasite. Maybe I have twin sun poisoning. Panic is unfamiliar. I remember it poorly from when I was a helpling, but it comes back now. Separated from my clan, lost in the woods as the moon set and true darkness set in. It would be hours before the first sun would come, and there was no certainty I would see it. I lose focus and the room goes dark like the woods. I snap back to attention. These helmets require focus, or it can be hard to see in them. TD-787 is doing the job, even if I'm not. He's flushed a pair of droids from the supply closet. I give them a cursory glance. They are not the droids I'm looking for. They direct us to the prison level, which is where we'd all rather be. It's all the excuse TD-787 needs to lead the unit to action. He leaves me to stand guard, alone with my thoughts. Is there something, anything I can do about my infraction on Tatooine? Should I report to the Moff now? In the middle of a mission? Do I leave my post? There's no telling how urgent the report could be. Those droids were important enough to dispatch a contingent to Tatooine, the most useless planet in the sector. For all I know, those droids hold the key to another millennium of Empire rule. For all I know, those were the most important droids in history. The protocol droid, the one I'm meant to be minding, interrupts my thoughts, bringing me back from Mos Eisley to the control room. He excuses himself and his counterpart. They have to go to maintenance. You and me both, I think bitterly, and wave the droids on their way. Again. I wave the droids on their way again. Recognition smacks me across the helmet. Those were the same droids. Tall, officious, goldy, and stubby blue. The old man on Tatooine must have spiked my intake unit somehow. There will be time for blame later. For now, I have to catch those droids. Before I can report that I'm in pursuit, my comm crackles to life, and I'm told to report to command. I no longer feel the tickle in my head. I feel warm, despite my suit's cooling system. I know with utter certainty that they've reviewed my feed. They know what I've done. My only hope is to redeem myself right now. There! The blue astromech rolls with purpose while Goldie struggles to keep up. I raise my firearm. Two shots is all it will take. My call sign rings out in my comm again. I shake it off and take aim. I'll put a hole through the blue one first. TD-110. Lower your weapon. The Moff sighs urbanely. And do report to command. Are you awaiting an engraved invitation? Consider this that. He looks at me from the corner of his eye. And go. But, I say, and he stops me with a look. I'm torn. I want to defend myself. I know my future hangs on this moment. I may grumble and grouse when I'm spent and tired, but all I possess in this life is the need to serve the Empire. Further comment is not required, TD-110. All that is required is compliance. I lower my weapon, bite my lip, and watch two droids leave the docking station. PB-106 relieves me of my weapon. He and his unit escort me to command. I know better than to speak unless spoken to, and they know better than to speak to me. I cannot read anything in PB-106's gait. Not sympathy, not duty, not anger. I'll never be able to ask, because the Moths have seen the feed, and now they'll expel me from the Death Star, probably to some floating ice chunk like Ottinger 7, to spend the remainder of my day shivering and dodging woolly long-tailed tods. I take in the hallways one last time. I love this place. More than anywhere I've been, it was home. I swear to the ancients of Parsh and the elders of the Empire, if I had to fight for 100 years, I will prove myself. I'll return to the Death Star. I swear, I will fight my way back home.
End of Watch by Adam Christopher. Commander Pamel Pohl rolled her neck and stood from the command chair, lifting the data pad in her hand to check the time. Just 10 minutes to go. 10 long, long minutes until the end of another 12-hour shift of, well, of almost nothing at all. 12 hours of routine, of protocol, of answering simple queries, giving simple orders. 12 hours of supervising a skeleton crew as they monitored the largely autonomous, redundant systems of the largest battle station in the history of the galaxy. And that suited Commander Pohl perfectly. She may have been a career officer, one dedicated more to the Imperial Navy than to the Emperor it served, but she was no warrior. Unlike many of her childhood friends who grew up in a more affluent sector of the Coruscant Ecumenopolis, Pohl had never had any desire to be a pilot or a field officer. She never had any desire to serve on the front lines, never had any desire to be a hero. Because the business of the Imperial Navy was one of war. And in war, being a hero got you killed. And with the Empire's struggle against the rebel insurgency feeling like it was about to reach a flashpoint, dying in battle was the last thing Pamel Pohl intended to do. No, Commander Pohl was an administrator. She reveled in the functions of an executive officer. Logistics, management, supervision. Yes, it was dull. It could be boring. But she enjoyed her work, and more important, she was good at it. Good enough to earn a quick promotion. Good enough to be assigned to the Empire's greatest technological achievement, the DS-1 Orbital Battle Station, as a station commander. That the Death Star didn't require much actual command was irrelevant. The battle station was so vast, 160 kilometers in diameter, with a full crew rumored to number more than 1 million, although the exact number remained classified, that it would be impossible for it to be run from a single control room or command center. What the Death Star had instead was a multitude of command posts, communications posts, and supervisor stations scattered at various levels across the station sectors, all of which fell under the watch of one of the 4 control rooms, each positioned mid-level in one of the station's hemispheres. Commander Pohl was assigned to Station Control West. And while it was possible for her to take direct control of the Death Star systems if absolutely required, Pohl was proud of the fact that hundreds of thousands of station crew in her hemisphere depended on her constant vigilance. As she put her datapad to sleep, Pohl glanced around the room. Station Control West, like its 3 counterparts, was a circular chamber, the circumference lined with monitor consoles at which sat 2 dozen ensigns and junior officers patiently staring at monitors, checking readings, the room filled with a constant sound of their murmuring as they quietly spoke into their headsets. Above the ring of consoles, four huge trapezoidal display screens shone, one at each of the compass points, providing a continuous stream of status information. The data was almost too much to take in, but Pol appreciated the at-a-glance updates for various systems she was responsible for, one of which had been causing something of a minor headache for the last 30 minutes. Pol stepped down from the command dais and folded her arms as she glanced up at the screen directly ahead. On it, a swarm of ever-moving, multicolored indicators representing traffic control for hangars 250 to 350 crawled like zest flies. But Pol ignored the confusing mess, focusing instead on a red block that pulsed on the left-hand side. Docking Bay 327 was on lockdown, all traffic diverted to bays 328 and 329. Flight delays were not uncommon, an unavoidable consequence of the sheer volume of traffic and coordination this required, both automated and manually supervised, between the 500 different hangars and docking bays that were buried all over the skin of the battle station. Having docking bay 327 out of action was, in reality, nothing more than a minor inconvenience. But it would remain an annoying status alert, sullying her otherwise perfect shift report, unless she could get the diversions cleared in the next, she checked the time on her datapad again, 7 minutes. Pol frowned and headed over to the monitor station beneath the display. Two crew were positioned at their control consoles. One, Ensign Tuce, hunched across the controls as he stared at a small square display in front of him, while his companion, Sub-Lieutenant Slaylin, leaned back in her seat, arms folded, shaking her head. As Pol approached, neither seemed aware of her presence. "Remind me again," said Slaylin. "What am I looking at here?" Tuce clicked his tongue and tapped the screen with an index finger. "Come on, you're telling me you don't recognize a classic when you see one?" he whistled softly between his teeth. "Just wait until I tell your brother when he gets back from Scarif." Slaylin cocked her head. "What I do recognize, Ensign, is a piece of junk when I see one. I'm amazed it didn't break up as soon as the tractor beam got a lock." "Piece of junk? Sub-Lieutenant Slaylin, I despair. I really do. That piece of junk, as you call it, is a YT-1300 light freighter," said Pol, resting one hand on the back of Slaylin's chair, "that is currently disrupting the docking bay schedule." Slaylin and Tuce immediately straightened up, their backs ramrod straight. Tuce cleared his throat.
"Yes, ma'am.
Sorry, ma'am." "Don't apologize, Ensign," said Pol. "Just get the docking bay cleared. Now." "Ma'am," said Slaylin, "Captain Kurgi still has a scanning crew aboard the vessel. We need an all clear from the hangar deck before we can lift the lockdown." "The scan still isn't finished? What are they doing down there?" Tuce and Slaylin said nothing, both junior officers just looking up at their commander. Pol sighed. "Fine," she said. "Continue monitoring and let me know when Captain Kurgi is done." On the other side of the control room, the turbo lift hissed open. Pol turned and saw her shift replacement step out. "Actually, no," said Pol. "You can let Commander Sheard know." Pol turned and gave Sheard a casual salute, which he returned before heading around the arc of the room toward her. Pol handed the datapad to her fellow officer and briefed him on the events of the last shift, in particular on the status of the mystery freighter currently holding up the schedule down in docking bay 327. Sheard nodded as he listened, brushing one index finger along the underside of his thick mustache. Then he tapped the back of Tuce's chair. "Show me the ship, main screen."
"Sir."
Ensign Tuce swung back around to his console. He snapped a switch, and the view of the freighter in the docking bay shown on his console screen flashed up to the main wall display. Tuce and Slaylin sat back and looked up at the image while Pol took a step back and tapped a finger on the edge of her datapad.
"I didn't even know these things were still flying," said Commander Sheard.
Pol nodded.
He was right. The YT-1300 was an old ship, virtually a relic. And the example down in Docking Bay 327 was no exception, she thought as she gazed up at the screen. The vessel was battered, the hull carbon scored in several places, the vector thrust plates that cradled the main drive ports in serious need of not just cleaning but replacing altogether. But there was something else about the ship. Pol had seen a couple of YT series freighters in her time, both long past their service and certainly not operational. And while she couldn't remember the exact models, this one looked, different. Wasn't the sensor dish larger than standard? And the dorsal armament? It was a quad laser cannon. The YT-1300 had weapons, certainly, but a gun like that just had to be unlicensed. Pol didn't know why the ship had been captured and dragged into the docking bay, but there was more than a fair chance it was smugglers or pirates. That made sense. The ship was modified, customized far beyond factory specs. Although quite what the Death Star was doing policing the hyperspace lanes was another question entirely. Pol cocked her head as she looked at the display. Ensign 2 said you had a brother on Scarif, Slaylin. Ship designer? Sub-Lieutenant Slaylin turned in her chair. Naval architect, ma'am. We took starship design together as an elective at the academy. But he was the one with the talent. She turned and pointed back at the main display. You don't see many working examples of this older kind ship. I'll have to send him a data tape once he's out of operations. What's his assignment? Asked Commander Sheard. Slaylin gave a shrug. I don't know, sir. The operation on Scarif is classified. I haven't heard from him in 4 weeks. She slumped just a little in her chair. We were due to meet for shore leave, but I haven't heard from him yet. I guess his operation has been extended. Quite possibly, said Pol, and she left it at that, because she knew something the sub-lieutenant clearly didn't. That the Death Star itself had been at Scarif and had left the system just 3 days ago. Slaylin was right. The operation on the planet was classified. Commander Pol had been on duty and was of a senior enough rank to have been informed of their destination. But even she hadn't known what the station's mission there was. There was talk in her mess that it was another shakedown run, something about a second test following the first one over the moon of Jeddah. Although a test of what, Pol didn't know. But that was the thing about the Death Star. The battle station was so big that, short of a Star Destroyer crashing into it, most of the crew would have no idea about what was going on at any given time. Only essential mission personnel had the required clearance. Pol understood that. It was a matter not just of security, but also of pure logistics. Pol nodded at Commander Sheard. Her watch was over, and it was time to go. Station Control West is... An alarm chimed from the console in front of Ensign 2's. Pol saw a red light flashing by his hand, quickly joined by another. Next to the ensign, Slaylin glanced over her own console, checking systems while Toos began cycling through a series of switches, peering at his monitor as he did so, a frown firmly etched on his face. Pol and Sheard exchanged a glance. Then Pol leaned over the console between her two junior officers. Something wrong?
Yes, ma'am. Maybe.
Toos flicked some more switches, then twisted a dial as he began cycling through a series of surveillance frequencies patched into the station's security system. On his small display, the view of the docking bay was replaced by screen after screen of roaring static as he flipped through the channels. At her console, Slaylin had one hand on her earpiece as she listened. Then she acknowledged the message and turned to the two commanders.
There's an alarm from Level 5, Detention Block AA-23. Subcontrol reports all sensors in the block have gone down.
Confirmed, said Toos, pointing to his display of rolling static. All cams are out.
Pol glanced at Commander Sheard, who folded his arms and stepped back.
All yours, Commander.
Thank you, she said, before turning back to the ensign. Put me through to the detention block. Tooth cycled his comm again and opened the channel. But the light beside the switch changed not from red to green as expected, but from red to blue.
They have their comm in secure mode. The ensign looked up at Commander Pol. We'll have to wait for them to answer.
Pol lifted her data pad and quickly swiped through to the station directory. Her eyes flicked over the data, then she nodded.
Detention block AA-23 is reserved for political prisoners, she said. To secure comm is standard.
Okay, let's just hope they answer quickly.
That was when the comm deck chimed. Pol moved closer to the console as Toos opened the channel. The ensign opened his mouth to speak, only for the operator on the other end to cut in first.
Everything's under control. Situation normal.
Pol glanced up at Sheard, who frowned. Toos and Slaylin looked at each other. Then Toos pressed the comm switch again. What happened?
Had a slight weapons malfunction, but, everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you.
Pol didn't recognize the voice, but whoever it was, they sounded almost breathless. She glanced down at her data pad to check, but then looked up in surprise as the voice spoke again.
How are you?
Toos looked back at Slaylin, who nodded. He leaned back over the comm.
We're sending a squad in.
The channel clicked back into life.
Negative. We have a reactor leak here. Now give us a few minutes to lock it down. Large leak, very dangerous.
Who's the duty officer down there? Asked Commander Sheard. Pol checked her data pad.
Lieutenant Childson.
Tooth shook his head.
Ma'am, that doesn't sound like Lieutenant Childson.
He pressed the comm button. Who is this? What's your operating number? Then the comm popped, and the control room was filled with a roar of white noise. Tooth winced and killed the volume, then tried the comm again.
Detention block AA-23, what is your status? Report, please.
He was answered by static. He tried a few more times, then gave up. Nothing. Calm down. Slaylin looked up at Commander Pol.
We should send a squad. I have a security team ready and waiting.
Pol held up a hand.
Keep them on standby.
She turned to Toos.
Ensign, systems report. If there's a reactor leak, it could be serious. We'll need to get engineering in.
Toos brought up data feeds at his console, then sat back and shook his head. He tapped a button, and the main screen changed from the docking bay view to a schematic of the power grid for this hemisphere of the station.
Power systems at normal status. Output is steady. No variables detected.
No reactor leak, then, said Slaylin.
Ma'am, the squad is ready to go.
Pol nodded.
Send them in. But we need to report this. Get me Grand Moff Tarkin.
Slaylin nodded and turned to her own comm deck, selecting the channel before calling it up.
Overbridge ready room,
came a female voice from the desk.
Grand Moff Tarkin, please.
Grand Moff Tarkin is currently in conference.
Commander Sheard shook his head and strode over to the command dais. He stepped up to the chair and pulled it around, then cut into Slaylin's comm channel from the panel on the armrest.
This is Station Control West, Commander Sheard. This is a priority red request. Put us through to the Grand Moff immediately.
One moment, sir.
The comm chimed again.
Yes.
It wasn't a question. It was just a statement, spoken by an old man with a clipped accent. Pol ground her teeth. She had only met Grand Moff Tarkin twice, and that was two times too many. Already she could imagine the cloying scent of Lavalel, the rich purple flowering herb that seemed to hang around the battle station's chief commanding officer like a cloud. She met Commander Sheard's gaze as he made his report to their superior.
We have an emergency alert in detention block AA-23.
The princess. Put all sections on alert.
Pol felt the breath catch in her throat. Princess? What princess? And then she heard the voice of the man Tarkin was in conference with. The deep, resonant bass voice echoing down the open comm channel. Well, perhaps man was the wrong word. Because who knew what was inside that suit?
Obi-Wan is here. The Force is with him.
The comm clicked off. Lord Vader, Tarkin's advisor, his enforcer. Paul knew he was aboard the station, but even so, hearing him speak sent a chill down her spine. She looked at Sheard and saw his throat bob as he gulped. It seemed that Vader had that effect on a lot of people. Then Paul realized that the control room had gone quiet, the constant murmuring of the crew absent as they all watched the two commanders. Now it was Paul's turn to swallow. Over at the console, Slaylin sat with her back rigid, her hands hovering over her console, ready to accept the next order. Beside her, Toos mimicked her posture, but he looked pale, his own hands curled tightly in his lap. Commander Paul gestured to the sub-lieutenant. "Send in the squad. Let's get the situation under control." Then she walked up to the command dais as, behind her, Slaylin gave the order.
"You're welcome to stay, Commander," said Sheard as he stood by the empty dais chair. But Paul, Rolderneck, took a deep breath and gave her colleague a smile.
"No thanks. My watch is done." "Good luck, Commander." As she headed to the turbo lift, ready for a shower, something to eat, something to drink, something quite strong, perhaps, Commander Pamel Pohl tried to ignore the growing sense of unease and the rolling ball of cold that seemed to have taken the place of her stomach. She didn't know what was going on. With the old freighter, with the detention block, and Tarkin had said princess, hadn't he? What was that about? But it wasn't her problem, not anymore. Let Sheard handle it. And she could read his report in the next shift. A shift that, Paul hoped, would be another 12 hours of glorious, routine boredom. Now that would be perfect.
The Baptist, by Nnedi Okorafor. There's something alive in here. Luke Skywalker. When they came, she wasn't ready. She was asleep, so her guard was down. Vodrans didn't usually come this deep into the swamps. They surrounded her before she could have known they were there. Still, Almy had the spirit of a warrior, and so she was fighting as she woke. Rough, leathery Vodran hands grasped each of Almy's tentacles, their thick, hard nails pressing into Almy's soft flesh, hauling her out of the water. They shouted instructions to one another in their oily language that always reminded her of the thin scum on the surface of the water when too much light came through the trees. She thrashed and rippled her flesh transparent, but she wasn't much bigger than each of them was. She twisted her body, attempting to bite at limbs or torsos, but she was caught. Then something stabbed into her, and she felt cold flood into the sensitive spot between two of her tentacles. Her strength left her. Through an awful haze, she was powerless to stop her capture. They rolled each of her tentacles into a large ball and shackled them all with thick, shiny, magnetized metal bands. She was fading, losing consciousness as she held up her eye stalk, taking in all the Vodran faces, hard, knobbed, expressionless. She fell into the darkness as several of them hauled her into the spherical tank that was like a body-sized bubble that would not pop. She should have looked around at the swamp, her home, one last time. But instead, she was unconscious before her body settled on the bottom of the tank. She dreamed of home. Soft lands she could travel over. Warm, rich waters, squelching mud, blasts of swamp gas, spindly trees. Here there was music, there was play, and there was plenty to eat and watch. Almy moved about the swamp, knowing that she belonged, her eye stalk swiveling as she traveled, seeing so much of the world. When she settled in for a deep night's sleep, she was safe and warm, her mind not on survival, but on where she planned to go next. Ami woke, instantly remembering that she'd been captured, and instinctively pulled her tentacles in. When she was sure nothing was grabbing her, she took inventory. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 tentacles. All intact. And so Ami settled some, glancing around. She was in a thick, clear, crystal sphere, its lid screwed on tightly, the better to preserve the gases in the swamp water. The sphere was positioned against a window among various other cargo. As far as she could tell, she was the only living thing in this place. Large and small white containers were stacked to the high ceiling. A narrow pathway led to an open door. Ami could see the swamplands right out her window, just beyond a flat, hard-looking plain of land. She'd seen these flying metal beasts before, passing across the sky, far above the trees, so large that one could be inside them and live. They flew here and there. She'd never imagined she'd be swallowed by one, contained in a crystal bowl. She pressed herself against her transparent prison, trying to get as close to home as possible. Everything began to rumble, the cargo stacks shaking but not falling. The water in her tank sloshed her this way and that. She turned her eye stalk to the window and realized her home was retreating. At first slowly, then faster than she could imagine. Something seemed to be pulling it down. What would happen to the swamplands if it was pressed into the ground? She shut her eye. Had this large beast just destroyed her home? And it was in this way Ami experienced her first sense of anti-gravity. She began to float about in her tank, losing her sense of location. None of this is possible, was all she kept thinking. None of this is possible. But it is happening. It was as if she were everywhere all at once. Where she had pressed herself to the sphere, trying to stay close to home, suddenly she felt her body wanted to be all over the sphere. She pulsated with terror, and after experiencing this intense emotion for several minutes, she felt something deep in her being click and let go. She floated upward and then turned to what her eye told her was upside down. But her other senses, like the feeling in her tentacles, the feel of the water, the heft of her body, told her differently. As she floated, she turned her eye back to the large window and stared for the first time deep into outer space. Her heart's beats quickened. This was a place she was not supposed to ever see. She was meant to travel the swamp, not into this beyond. She felt herself pulled forcibly toward space. She pressed against the round glass of the sphere, and suddenly all the rushing and flushing and flowing and stress in her seven tentacles and head stopped. Everything stopped. Quiet. Nothing. But everything. There was purpose. Ami twitched. Then involuntarily her body shifted to being transparent, and then the black color with pricks of starlight. Home will stay home, but you must go, she understood more than heard. And she knew deep in her heart that she would not die. No. She was in the right place. In the right moment. Stay your path. This time she heard the words in the deep, complex, humming language that her people often spoke in when they weren't feeding. To speak this language was to scare away all nearby food, the reverberations carried so completely in the water. To hear it now was like feeling a final breeze from home. Though she was gazing into space, she heard the voice humming from her flesh. Maybe it came from within the tiny links that her people said chained with one another to form her flesh. There was a great flash, and Ami instantly knew. She was positive, at least in that moment, that this place she was in was going to burn. Then the moment passed, and she was no longer sure of anything. Except that feeling of oneness. What did that feeling even mean, though? She was no longer so sure. Maybe it was just her fear of death. Not so long ago, she'd been similarly forgetful when she'd gotten into a battle with another of her clan. She remembered that this one had identified as male, and they'd met while crossing over a piece of land going in opposite directions. His name had been Iduna, and she'd been intrigued by his male identity. Her people could choose the gender they wanted. They were physically hermaphroditic, so one's choice said much about one as an individual. In her years, she'd met several females, and even more who were Dianogus, the most common gender. But she'd never met a male until this moment. He had wanted to exchange a few eggs. She had refused, and that was when he grew angry. They'd fought a violent, bloody battle, and during this battle, she'd fought with great focus and precision. To her, the battle had been like an argument that she controlled and eventually won. Iduna soon realized that if he didn't flee, she'd kill him. Thankfully, Iduna chose not to die. Ami may have surprised herself with her incredible combat skills, but as she fought, the terror of the experience, the fear of death, left her so forgetful that she couldn't remember from which direction she'd come. This was how she'd wound up in the southern part of the land instead of the western, napping in the perfect place to be kidnapped and taken into space. What must have been days passed, and Ami was still wondering if the vision of this place going up in flames had been inspired by her intense fear. Obsessing over the fiery vision was all that kept her restlessness and anger over being kidnapped at bay. Her sense of up and down had returned, and Ami felt she could think clearly. Twice, a Vodran had come and sprinkled some smelly but somehow bland dried fish through a small hole in the lid. It was the taste of this fish that stoked Almi's already heated anger enough to make her escape attempt. Back home, everything had flavor, juices, salt, the spice of food the fish had eaten in their bellies. But these people kidnapped her and then fed her food that was an insult. And her only view was of star-filled outer space and the white cargo on the other side of her sphere. She had to get out of here. She felt around the lid of her prison with her tentacles, gently touching every gap, even the tiniest ones, testing the pressure. The lid was made of a smooth, hard substance she had never felt before, and it smelled tangy and smoky. The material it was made of was weak. She pushed and felt some give. She pushed again, using her suckers to grip and turn. The lid clicked and began to easily slide in a circle. Around and around it went until it fell to the floor with a dull thud. She waited and then extended her eye stalk from her swamp water prison. She hauled herself out. Back in the swamp, she'd moved freely over the damp land from one body of water to the next. Leaving the sphere was not much different. Instead of trees, she skirted hard containers made of the same smoky, tangy-smelling, weak material. And instead of moist, fragrant air caressing her skin, the atmosphere was dry and crackling and sucked at her flesh. But the ground was flat, and she moved easily enough over it, smooth and black. When she slithered into the hallway, she paused, all angles, dead, everything smooth and hard and blacker. The insides of this space-traveling beast were either rotten or dead. Never in her life had she seen such a place. But she was still rather young, so there was always more to see. For a second, she returned to that epic moment when she'd looked out into space and become one with it. And with it came her vision that this place was going to go up in flames. Would that be because this beast was going to fly into a sun? She couldn't think about that now. Her front tentacle twitched. Something was coming. She felt it arriving before she saw it, the vibration buzzing across the floor. And so she pressed herself against the wall, turning herself black and shiny, blending in perfectly. The creature rolled up the hall like a large black mouse, or more accurately to Ami, an insect. Black and pod-like in body, swift in motion. Something about it was not right. Ami pressed herself flatter against and up the wall. Like the giant beast they were all traveling in, this large insect was not alive. Ami was sure of it. It zipped by without even noticing how the wall bulged, despite being the same color and sheen. Ami stayed this way for several minutes as other similar dead creatures zipped and walked up and down the hall. Some tiny as swamp turtles, others tall as bodrings, and one as large as a hut. Then Ami did see one of the huts pass by with what could have been a vaudrin in white, hard casing. When the hallway finally grew quiet again, Ami knew this had to be her chance for escape. She smelled moisture nearby. It was beyond the hard walls, and she had to find it before she completely dried out. She rolled into the middle of the hallway, her flesh aching from the lack of moisture. Dropping her black coloring to her usual mature, deep purple, she slithered toward the smell of water. She'd reached the end of the hall when two Vodran-like individuals encased in white nearly stepped on her. One exclaimed in a language that was not Vodran. The other pointed something black and long at her. Somehow she knew to move before it blasted fire. A smoking crater appeared beside her. She only had seconds. Back, toward the one closest to her, instead of away. She was in a hurricane of terror again, just as she had been during the fight with the male member of her tribe, when she'd been fighting for her life. With her terror came that sweet clarity. She shot her two front tentacles toward him, moving like a zipfish. She had to be impossible. She could not miss the parts of its body she needed to grasp. Milliseconds she could not miss, or she was going to die. She was not meant to die here in this cold, dead place. She was entitled to so much more. She couldn't miss. There was that voice again, reverberating through the space between the milliseconds, through the space in her flesh, telling her to trust, submit. She grasped his legs and was on him in seconds with the spur in her left tentacle. And in this way, she stung. She could not see the other. This was the weakness of having only one eye stalk. Her blind spots were many. But she could see in other ways sometimes. Yes. The one was stumbling back, turning toward the other, raising its weapon. She could smell the smoke from the burned ground. She leapt. And as she spun in the air toward the second one, all her tentacles flew out, and for a moment, she was a huge 7-point star in space. Her back tentacle slapped him first, then her other three. The fifth and sixth grasped him, and the seventh dug her poison spur right through its white helmet into the meaty, soft flesh beneath. It felt similar to smashing through the shell of a large crab. Ami slapped wetly on the floor, her body now screaming with pain. She stared at what she'd done. She swiveled her eye stalk to look up the hallway in one direction and then the other. Her suckers could taste the ground. There was water nearby. But could she make it there without being discovered again? And was the water just another container? For the first time, she wondered where she could even go in here, within this beast that would eventually burn. Ami decided to return the way she'd come, quickly. Moving and hiding, slowly, gradually. Even as chaos erupted behind her when the bodies were discovered, she stayed her course and eventually made it back to the transparent bowl, lifting the large lid and pulling it over her. She'd twisted it firmly back in place and settled on the bottom of the bowl in a scrunched ball just as the guards burst in. She shut her eyes, feeling their scrutiny as they approached her. From underwater, she heard their garbled voices as they stepped up to the glass and tapped on it. She lazily opened her eye and closed it. After a few seconds, she cracked her eye open a bit and watched one of them test the bowl lid's tightness. After walking around her bowl and searching the storage room, the two of them left, and Ami found herself alone again. She stared out into space. Her painful skin recovered to its hydrated self in the swamp water. At least there was that. After a while, Ami stopped caring about how much time had passed. They came and fed her smelly fish, sometimes chopped up, sometimes whole. Disgusting fish that didn't taste like anything from her home, and when she ate, she missed home that much more. They placed two solid metal bars over the top of her bowl, but only she knew that doing this was a waste of time. She had no intention of escaping. There was nowhere to escape to on this doomed vessel. Living or dead animal, it didn't matter to her. All she could do was wait. Eventually, who knew? Maybe there would be another chance to escape somewhere. On some planet. And then she saw it. First from a distance in space, and then closer and closer and closer. It looked like a fruit of the dead. Suspended there in space, the size of a moon. Soon it filled the view in the window, and Ami could not see above, around, or below it. It became the world. And into it they flew. For a second time, Ami felt the disorientation of adjusting to another type of gravity, that of this huge dead moon. She was nowhere. Then she knew the bottom of her bowl, and she settled down in it. When they came again, she was asleep. The bowl shook as it was hauled away on what looked like a large, flat insect. She was taken down the sterile corridors, this time far past the place where she'd killed the two individuals in her aborted quest for freedom. The spot where it had all happened was clear, unoccupied. And then they were moving through the biggest inside place Ami had ever seen. The ceiling looked high as the sky, but it was a ceiling. She could see that. At the top were more bars, and then a network of metal tubes. In this place, she saw more metal birds and insects and Vodran-like people in white casing, hundreds of them. The ground was smooth, like the tops of ancient dead swamp trees that had been blasted by the winds. She'd climbed one of those trees once, out of curiosity. Its surface was so dry, the winds near the top so biting. She'd probably never do that again. They entered a narrow, dim black tunnel where the ground became porous, red light shining through perfect tiny square holes. Not land, a sort of rigid grate that could hold all of their weight. The sound of the feet of those escorting her tapped on the hard surface as they walked. They stopped at a large hole in the wall with the squiggles 3263827 etched above the entrance. And that was when she was sure she was going to die. The symbols looked like images of what her body would look like if they tore her apart. Was this where they were going to eat her? She could smell organic matter, strong and pungent, in a way that reminded her of home. The insect beneath her rose, somehow lifting the large, water-filled bowl. It dumped her and her swamp water into the hole, and then Ami was tumbling down a black tunnel, throwing out her tentacles but unable to gain purchase. Her head bumped the side, her mouth of sharp teeth clattering together. She pulled her tentacles and eye stalk in and tucked her head as close to herself as possible. Flash! She plunged into a soup of water, metal parts, pieces that were not metal but were just as dead. Excrement from the Vodran-like people who ran the ship and other organic matter. As bits and pieces bumped and pressed against her body, she let herself sink, still in a protective ball until she softly bounced onto the bottom. She waited. Some of the floating things around her were hard, some of them soft, none of them alive. She smelled things she could eat that were better than the smelly alien fish. Slowly, she reached out a tentacle and suckered the ground beneath her. Metal. And not all smooth. She knotted herself up again and stayed like this for hours. What she learned in that time was that this place was dimly lit by dirty lights on the ceiling. The water was tepid, and every so often garbage would fall into it, giving Ami something new to eat. It wasn't home, but it was as close to it as she could come in the middle of space. Over time, Ami grew to understand that she was on a dead planet that had never been alive. A planet that was small and made of materials that would never know life. But things she could consume were dumped into the false swamp, and she supposed this was why she was captured and dumped there. She grew strong and large. She missed home and wished she could find a clear tank with no lid beside a window where she could see the vastness of space. But she also never forgot that she had a purpose, though she didn't know what it was. Ami survived the false swamp by memorizing the routine of the walls. Twice a day, the thick metal walls would rumble once, quietly, then rumble again and slowly march toward each other. The first time this had happened, Ami had not panicked. She'd spent hours exploring the false swamp, learning its shallows and depth, its perimeter, searching for an escape. There was a large pipe near the bottom whose opening was protected by an invisible barrier until that moment when it flushed out much of the old water during these wall marches. However, there was also a large indenture near the bottom where something too impossibly hard had made a deep dent in the left wall. When the walls marched, she pressed herself here, protected even when the walls had pressed all the debris that she did not consume into a thick sheet. The sheet was ejected through a long slot below. On that fateful day, an hour before it happened, Ami saw outer space again. When she was inside, with no window, it was impossible. She was in her spot just as the sheet of compressed metals and dead materials was ejected. In that moment, everything seemed to burst from her mind. Suddenly, after so much time being by herself, here she was not alone. And what was with her was vast and beautiful. Again, she involuntarily shifted her flesh to the black of space with speckles of distant stars. And whatever was with her told her again through her skin that she had a mission and it would be in this false swamp. It told Ami that she was in the right place at the right time. By the time the walls marched themselves apart, she was alone again. The walls were moving away, but they simultaneously seemed to close in on her because again she had the vision of everything going up in flames, and again she wanted to escape her prison. But she had her mission first. More garbage was dumped into the false swamp, and soon she found a large hunk of rotting meat, consumed it, and settled in the corner as the fresh garbage soaked up the water. 5 minutes later, the four fell into her prison. Almy's tentacles twitched as she immediately recognized something in the smaller male. Yes, that one was male, not just by choice, but by physical design. However, there was something about him that was like her. She could smell it on him. He had just left home, too, as she had so long ago. There was that, but there was something else as well, if she relaxed and focused completely on him. There was something sparkly and electric that she felt in every part of her flesh. She did not understand their languages, and she wished she could. The first thing she'd have demanded of this one was to know why he could submit to it, too. Because if he had not already, she knew he would eventually. Just as she had back when she had faced and killed those two white-shelled individuals when she was trying to escape. She climbed out of the water, changing to its dirty gray color beneath the dingy pink lighting, suctioning her tentacles to the wall so that she could get a better look. There she stayed, her tentacles spread, like a giant spider on the wall. One was a hairless female, and three were larger males, one of them protected by fur. Ami would beware of the female, despite her lack of hair. The female would be most savage and cunning. If any of them could kill Ami, it would be that one. Ami dropped into the water with a soft splash. She flattened herself and moved stealthily around their feet. When she brushed the small male's leg, she heard it speak to her again, her tentacles tingling with its demand. She didn't want to. She had plenty of food down here, meat, bones, thick green stalks she'd come to especially enjoy. And all she sensed from these four who could not see her was fear. Ami had no reason to harm any of them. She knew when she did it. It was her choice. Despite the fact that it felt as if she'd made the choice while part of something greater. Yes. She rolled smoothly beneath the surface, then tumbled and stretched four tentacles before her. She opened her mouth and could not resist letting out a roar from deep in her body, the rumble of her speech reverberating beneath the false swamp and along the metal walls to the ceiling. The individuals shuddered, spoke among themselves, freezing and looking around. She poked her eye stalk up, needing to see his face. Then she wrapped a tentacle around him and pulled him under. He was screaming and thrashing, then choking. Back home, sometimes the sky would twirl and fight itself, and light would crash down into the water. If this happened close to where Ami was hiding, she'd feel her entire body tense up, becoming hard as stone, and she'd feel the light traveling through her. Touching him was like this. Everything in her body was aware of everything in him. She wondered if everything in him was aware of everything in her. She wondered if this creature could be her mate, not for procreating, but for adventure. It was his destiny to leave home, too. She was sure of her mission, but now she was also unsure. What if he died? Something blasted past her, red and hot. The others were attacking. Pain exploded in one of her tentacles, and the water around her turned blue with her blood. She let go and flung him back to the surface. Her back tentacle hung limply, a gaping hole in its center. She pulled it close to her body, and a second, even more powerful explosion of pain vibrated through her so intensely that for a moment she lost consciousness. But the energy in her, around her, through her, was stronger. She had a mission, and it was right now. She pulled him down again. He fought her, but she was stronger. She held him still, wrapping her three other thick tentacles around him. She heard a brilliant humming, and it vibrated through her body. For the third time, she saw that this place, along with the small beast she'd arrived in, would all go up in flames. What was happening to him now, though? As he struggled, pulled at her tentacles, kicking his legs, bubbles of air escaping from his mouth, he was shedding. No, not the protective material he wore over his flesh. With her sharp eyes, she saw it. A shade of him sloughed off, the flesh of this shade pale and delicate-looking, naked. It shook off him, the face of this dim version of him wide-eyed, the mouth open, shocked. Then the shade dissolved in the water. Ami's mission was complete. She was so preoccupied with what she'd seen that she nearly forgot to release him. Nearly. When she did, he swam frantically to the surface. The walls rumbled. As she fled to her space in the wall, she knew he would be okay. And when the walls stopped their usual march forward to press all the remaining metal and waste into a sheet, she was not surprised. Even when one of the larger males spat one more ball of fire into the false swamp after they'd gotten out, she wasn't afraid. Soon the four were gone, and Ami never again saw the one who was so much like her. But she trusted that he went on to do great things, for she'd been chosen to baptize him through a sort of death. To her people, water was where life was given. Water was the great cleanser when it was time to be cleansed. And this was also true for those who could not live in it. Ami's injured tentacle fell off and grew back. She went on living in the false swamp, swimming about, eating its garbage, hiding in her safe space. Days, months, she did not know. There was no dim sun with which she could mark time. There were no other people of her tribe to tell her the time. However, once in a while, that which she could feel in her flesh and beyond spoke to her and told her stories of the universe. It told her of peoples, places, wars, and deep lessons. It taught her how to spin her body in ways she did not think were possible until she did them. In that dim place, she learned how to make a large, twisted hunk of metal and two pieces of waterlogged insulation lift into the air like great birds. Or maybe Ami was just talking to and teaching herself, and all her knowledge came from within her very cells. When the fire came that consumed every part of the great beast she'd been swallowed by, Ami submitted to her destiny. And her last thought was, who will I be the next time around?
Time of Death by Kevin Scott. My name is Obi-Wan Kenobi, and I am dead. I know how that sounds. Crazy old Ben with his crazy old stories. But this isn't crazy, this is happening. At least I think it is. One minute I am standing in the heart of the Empire's new battle station, facing the man who, for good or ill, has defined the last 30 years of my life. I close my eyes and wait, hearing the sweep of his lightsaber and... And what? What happens next? If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can ever imagine. Did I say...